God, I'd kick it in the head when he was 25. Speed jive, don't wanna stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, Sam with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you get, I'm a dude now.
The young dude.
Hey, dude.
Carry the news.
Where are you?
Dude.
Knock, knock.
Carry the news.
It's Michael Hoople. The track is All the Young Dudes, and playing that track today because the album of the same name was released on this day, September the 8th in 1972, and that track was written by David Bowie, and the album was also produced by Bowie, and Mott the Hooper were fronted by Ian Hunter, who incidentally wrote a brilliant memoir. It was titled Diary of a Rock and Roll Star. And the band, Mott the Hoople, took their name from a little-known novel that came out in 1966. It was called Mott the Hoople, and it was written by one Willard Manis. And I haven't read it, but apparently Mott the Hoople, the novel, opens with its protagonist, the overweight, lazy, yet fancifully imaginative Norman Mott, driving into town to visit his girlfriend Sandra Patterson at college. He attempts to make love to Sandra, but is thwarted by her sexual repression at the hands of her mother, who is a disciple of the evangelist Reverend Smiley Harley Gurry. Between her mother's influence and the experience of being tricked into a sham marriage as a teenager, Sandra is so apprehensive about sex that she becomes extremely flatulent every time a man makes sexual advances to her. So, not sure what to make of that novel, but apparently Willard Manis is still alive. He'll be 91 this year. That's quite a plot twist, isn't it, Ellen?
Very much so, yes. It's a great song. To think that Bowie could afford to give away songs of that quality, I think that's that says a lot. And I guess one of the things about Bowie is that maybe many people will remember where they were when they heard that he died. He was sort of the JFK of our generation, maybe.
Yes, a big pause there, perhaps. a JFK of our generation, Amy? David Bowie?
I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but definitely a legend in the industry, one of those people who just transcended generations and periods. But, a bit of a fan of Bowie stuff myself.
I do want to put in a word there again for Ian Hunter, though, because that memoir is one of the best music memoirs of all time, that Diary of a Rock and Roll Star. It's now 26 minutes to five, and you're on the panel, and lots of response about webcams. The thing with webcams are people don't set them upright. It's all about the height of the camera, how far you sit back from it, lighting and background. But really, who has time to do that? I'm not sure I do. And Michelle says, I love the Skype Teams fake backgrounds. Do either of you use those?
No, I can't work it out. I tried the other day to do one of those backgrounds and it completely failed. All I could do was make it blur. That's about as techno as I've managed to get.
Sandra says, thank goodness it wasn't just me who felt so old, wrinkly and haggard. Zoom's interesting. And hi, Karen. I found with the Zoom meetings, etc., that I wear a whole lot less makeup. It's fantastic. Our text number here is 2101. It's 26 minutes to 5. Amy Adams and Ellen Blackman are my guests on the panel this afternoon. And we were talking earlier about how climate change may shape the future in regard to touring bands or whether they'll come here at all. But animals, besides humans, are already adapting to increased temperatures. Apparently warm-blooded animals are changing beaks, legs and ears and tails to adapt to a hotter climate and to be able to better regulate their temperature. And this was a study by a bird researcher from Deakin University. She calls it shape-shifting. She says shape-shifting does not mean that animals are coping with climate change and that it's all fine. It just means they're evolving to survive it. But we're not sure what the other ecological consequences of these changes are, or indeed that all species are capable of changing and surviving. We're going to be talking about climate change and New Zealanders' attitude to it in a moment. But I just wanted to ask either of our panellists if they've noticed any evolutionary changes themselves, within themselves. Ellen?
I don't think evolution works quite that quickly, but I can't say I've noticed it specifically for myself. I don't seem to enjoy the cold as much, but maybe that's just me getting older.
Ears getting any bigger, Ellen?
Yeah, well, I think that's the only part of your body that keeps growing, isn't it? But I've moved from Dunedin to Auckland, and I don't think I could go back. I couldn't do the cold, so maybe I've evolved in that way to be used to the warmer climes. I don't know.
It is good to hear that mammals and birds are evolving. I mean, the fact that they have to is not good, but good that they are in some way responding to it. And I guess they have to survive. But the survey that came out, it was an international survey, has found that we New Zealanders, we're behind the global average when it comes to prioritising the need for urgent action on climate change. The Ipsos Global Advisor Survey, it found that 57% in New Zealand feel that the government needs to act now, and that's lower than Great Britain at 69% and Australia at 63%, and the global average was 65%. So Dr. Jagadish Thacker, JT, he's a senior lecturer at Massey University specialising in climate change communication, and he joins me now. Kia ora.
Kia ora, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. What did you find most striking about these survey results?
So, firstly, we have very few international polls that also include a sample of New Zealanders. So it's good to see our place in the world, actually.
I was just going to say there was over 1,000 of us that responded, 1,010, I believe.
Yeah, and that's a good sample size. And as you said, something surprising for me was that Kiwis show a lower priority to climate change than Australians, and I think that's a national shame.
Well, why do you put this low? What do you put this low ranking down to? It appears by reading this that we have faith in the government to do it for us. We trust them that they'll just take over, and we don't need to do anything. By the sound of things,
yeah, I think the reflects a general high level of trust in the government. We see it as a responsibility for the government, and we want to lead. We want the government to lead us on this. But I think there are other issues as well. For example, some of us might feel climate change is distant in time and in space. Some of us might feel we are just too small to, you know, change a global problem. Our individual actions don't matter as much.
And also because who we are and, you know, our farming background, our distance from the rest of the world, there are reasons why we might answer in this way.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the behaviors that we don't want to change in the next year for climate change was, less dairy and less meat. So we actually rank quite low on that. In fact, we rank at the bottom of people in the countries who want to change their flights or avoid flight travels next year.
So why aren't we reacting with the same urgency, perhaps as we have with COVID-19? Amy, what's your view on that?
Oh, I think it's a complex science issue to start with, right?
Yeah, sorry, JT. Amy, yeah, sorry to interrupt you.
I find this really interesting, and I wondered a bit about whether it was the way that the question was shaped around, you know, the government's interest in it. And I sometimes, when I talk to New Zealanders, they know it's a serious issue, they know the world has to deal with it, but they seem to think it's something that really, you know, that the Indias and the Chinas and the USs of the world have to be the ones to step up on. So I wondered if it was more a reflection of New Zealand's role in it rather than a reflection of New Zealanders perhaps not caring about climate change as much. You know, small sample, but certainly the people I talk to would rank it hugely highly as a critical issue, but perhaps less highly in terms of the role of the New Zealand government and the ability of the New Zealand government to make the sort of changes the world needs to see.
JT, is there a difference between the age groups and what they're feeling about climate change?
Yeah, so this survey shows that there is a clear age group. Younger people are more interested, they want to take more action than their older counterparts. But there was a recent study published in Nature that actually found that while there is a gap, it hasn't increased over the years. So among young as well as old, concern about climate change has gone up in the last 10 years.
Alan, do these results ring true to you? What are you hearing from your students?
not a lot right at the moment.
No.
But I guess my feeling about this is that it's kind of like the sort of the frog in the pot of boiling water sort of thing. You know, you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, it'll jump out. But if you put it in a pot of cold water and warm it up slowly, then it'll boil to death. And I think the problem with climate change is that the effects are so slow to become manifest. And I think everybody's just thinking, well, you know, there's no big change. And, oh, you know, it's only 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees. You know, how bad could that be? And I think that's probably the big problem, is that we're just not seeing the effects. And probably by the time you do get to see the effects, you know, when they're really bad, then it's going to be too late.
But is that true, though, JT? We're seeing the effects everywhere.
Yeah, I know. I mean, especially this year with floods across the world. I mean, last year it was forest fires and such, even now in California and other countries. Yeah, I think the problem is that when the media is covering it, it's not covering as a climate change story, the extreme weather events and such. Even with the IPCC report released recently, these events get covered separately as a flood event or such. And people don't understand sort of the drivers of the intensity and extremity of these weather events. So I think the people have very few learning opportunities on climate change, and the media is not doing enough.
That's a very interesting thought, because the media around the world will attribute something that's happening, a flood, tornado, to climate change, whereas we don't tend to do it here in New Zealand. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly it was we didn't have such good science to make those connections. I think in recent years, the scientists have become more innovative to understand the climate imprint on extreme weather events. One is we're getting better science, but I think journalists still are not sure about reporting these extreme weather events as climate change, human impact stories.
It paints a pretty bleak picture about what we believe. I mean, we're only a few percentage down from the rest of the world, but surely, given we like to consider ourselves to be clean and green, we should be right up there. It should be 80% of us, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the government, I feel, in many ways is showing leadership, and we are trusting the government to do that and not relying on individual action. But I think individual action is important. The business action is important as well.
Alan, this is an interesting text. Climate change. I lived in Europe for only 2 years, and when I returned to New Zealand, I was struck and deeply disturbed by the relaxed culture of people here when it comes to the climate crisis as well as other important issues. Mm. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think I would. I think the thing is that we don't see the effects manifested in New Zealand per se. I mean, yes, you see them around the world, of course, you know, these terrible high temperatures in Canada not so long ago and floods and everything. But, you know, they happen every year, and the naysayers can just say, oh, you know, that just happens. We have forest fires every year. We have floods. We have cyclones, hurricanes, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we're not seeing maybe massive storms here. We're not seeing desertification or things like that in New Zealand. And so maybe we just sort of sit around and think, yeah, no, this is probably the rest of the world's problem. We're okay. We're well away from it, which is not a great way to think. But, you know.
This texter says COVID is clear and present danger. It kills people. Climate change gradual, and many think not in their lifetimes.
Yeah, exactly.
We are seeing the effects everywhere. I agree. Sadly, tipping points already surpassed. Famine, war, biodiversity, apocalypse and natural disasters await. Well, that's a bit doom-mongering. But JT, is that how you think when you're talking about climate change, or are you looking at a more positive way forward?
Oh, I think we need to help people to translate experience into understanding and action. So, yeah, we have experienced all these weird extreme weather events, but, you know, unless I can link that to climate change and specifically to actions I can take to reduce climate impacts, I think it's just the experience itself is not going to be quite a useful learning thing.
Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon. And how are things where you are, by the way?
Oh, not bad. You know, back to classes this week.
Yes, which is good. And yeah. level 2+.
Yeah, I know, but I hope everybody just follows the safety precautions.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's JT Jagadish Thacker, a senior lecturer at Massey University, specialising in climate change communication. It's now 4:45 on the panel. My panellists are Alan Blackman and Amy Adams. Somebody's moving their camera or microphone there. Is that you, Alan, again, is it?
No. I'm not moving.
I think it is.
Absolutely.
Actually, I wish I could see you. Well, a story now, but more serious story, and particularly for those who are addicted to drugs and alcohol in the South, they're being referred for treatment, but they're having to wait for up to 2 years to get it. According to Tuare Potiki, the under-resourcing means that the damage and harm caused to whānau and communities from people having to wait that long is immense, and often people don't last for 2 years. They either end up in prison or dead. Well, those are very sobering words, if that's the right word. Well, Tuare is the acting chair of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, and he joins us now. Tēnā koe, Tuare.
Kia ora. Tēnā koe. Kia ora.
What drugs are we talking about? Opioids, meth, and alcohol? What are they having to wait to get treatment for?
I think it's a combination. I think the issue you referred to specifically was for opioid substitution treatment, which is methadone, and it was for, I'm pretty sure it was Southland, just sort of one part of the region. As a rule, you know, it's sort of variable. I think it depends on where you are in the country as to how long you have to wait, but waiting lists are not a new thing or an unusual thing.
Well, what's driving the delay? Do we not have enough counsellors?
No, I think, well, it's an interesting one. I think in many ways it's symptomatic of what the Minister of Health has called the postcode lottery, of you know, what you get health-wise depends on where you live. So I know that there are literally hundreds of alcohol and drug clinicians scattered throughout the country who work incredibly hard and often quite trying circumstances. But for quite a while now, the sector have been saying that something like 100,000 New Zealanders need some sort of support with their alcohol and drug use each year. And of those 100,000, about 50,000 are able to access some sort of support. So there's always been a significant unmet need. So it's definitely not a new thing. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's more about how the system, how the DHB kind of environment has in many ways fostered regional approaches. Which have meant that, like I say, some put more energy and resource into alcohol and drug counselling than others.
So you say a postcode lottery, and if, for example, you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, is going to see someone, are you forced into it, or are you talking about people who just off their own bat go in and say, look, I want help? Or are you through the system, or both?
Both. So it's a... Some people are forced into it, forced as in often through the courts, but also there's some pressure, and it'll either be through the law, getting into trouble, or it could be whānau, it could be a relationship, it could be an employment issue, or it could be a mental health issue where, you know, you get to a point where someone else is suggesting or that you need to have a look at your alcohol and or drug use. So I think... often there aren't many people who aren't kind of coerced, pressured in some way, who just walk into an alcohol and drug service and need an alcohol and drug assessment. So I think there's always an element of pressure. But yes, definitely some of them, we're talking both self-referrals and also those who are referred from GPs or others. Yeah.
So if you're waiting for 2 years in order to get treatment, as you say, a lot's going to happen in those 2 years. That's a very long time.
I mean, I wasn't being melodramatic. I mean, having worked in the sector for a long time and also been a client of the sector, I know that the window of opportunity, when people are willing to receive help, often that window can be quite... the time-wise can be quite a short opportunity. And if the help isn't immediately available, then because of the nature of drug and or alcohol use, it does mean that people will end up, in accidents, in hospital, in jail, or some definitely end up dead. They don't last, that they can't survive the waiting list. So, I'm not being sort of melodramatic. It's a fact, and it's, obviously to do with the nature of the substance and the nature of drug addiction and alcohol addiction as well.
Yes. Amy, in your time in the House, you were both Minister for Justice and Minister for Courts. So any suggestions?
Yeah, well, what I can say from that piece of experience is that, when we would see people go through the justice system, I remember seeing one chap who was in his mid-30s and he had 140-odd convictions all based around effectively feeding his drug habit. And if we think as a society that the first 140 convictions didn't change his behaviour, then 141 isn't going to. So we were very clear that the only way we were going to make a substantial difference to this sort of stuff was through dealing with the underlying drug and alcohol addiction. And I've got to give a massive shout out to the alcohol and drug dependency courts who have tackled this completely differently with outstanding success. But as has been mentioned, it's absolutely dependent on the available of good services. And this is not just a short thing. This is often working with people for 18 months, 2 years or more to help them get their life back on track. But if we don't do it, the cost is enormous, absolutely enormous. And so if whatever we think about the cost of doing it, once you start to quantify the full downstream of cost, not just for the person, but for their whānau, for their employers, for their victims, the cost of not being able to do it is as I say, just eye-watering. And, I watched a thing on the news last night talking about the free availability of drugs during lockdown. And I thought, what sort of society have we got where it's easier to get drugs in lockdown than it is to get building supplies? I mean, it is, I don't mean to be dismissive about it, but this stuff is not going away. And as a society, we simply shouldn't accept there not being the help for the people who are brave enough to put their hand up to want to get it.
Tuari, why are there more drugs available when everyone's in lockdown? Doesn't seem logical.
I'm not sure that there are. I guess my problem with that is the false separation between alcohol and other drugs. And that does bother me because the most commonly available and the most harmful drug available is alcohol, without a doubt. And we have deemed that to be essential during lockdowns, during COVID. Alcohol outlets have been able to stay open and supermarkets obviously continue to sell alcohol. So I think this needs to be kept in perspective that we, we tend to kind of frown on drugs and see drugs other than alcohol as somehow being worse or more problematic or worthy of greater attention or more punishment. My first thing would be to question that. Secondly, I'm not sure that more drugs are available. I think, we live in a pretty alcohol and drug fueled society, and I think it just becomes more sort of prominent. I think alcohol consumption also goes up during lockdowns because, for obvious reasons, people have got more time on their hands, maybe less, fewer recreational options, and others that are just needing to cope with being locked, locked down, for some people is locked in for others. So, I think generally alcohol and drug use across the board goes up during lockdowns, but I wouldn't say that's just a drug thing at all. I think it's just, the way these things seem to pan out.
So when somebody does finally get in for treatment, how successful is it for those who go through the system?
It can be really, really successful. I think obviously there's a combination of factors that, alcohol and drug treatment is hugely effective for probably half of the people who access it immediately. And then, as Amy mentioned, others will need repeated doses. It's a bit like giving up smoking. They say most people it takes about 7 attempts. I think it's the same with alcohol and drug issues. But look, there are literally thousands of people out there now walking around who have successfully dealt with their alcohol and or drug use issues. And it's also worth saying that, you know, that there is again a tendency to talk about drugs in the context of crime, and that I think paints a really false picture. When I went through treatment in 1988, there were 7 doctors in the treatment centre that I was at. So it doesn't just affect sort of, you know, people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds or criminals. Alcohol and drug addiction affects literally the whole of society. It's just that some have more resources at their disposal so that, you know, they don't end up in court or on the front page of the newspaper. So again, you know, I think there is we need to acknowledge that anyone in any walk of life at any age can experience problems with alcohol and or drugs, and they don't have to be permanent. You know, they can be with treatment, they can be sorted out, and people can move on and live really happy and healthy lives.
That's a good way of looking at it. Alan, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I guess the story is specifically for the Southern DHB. So I'm just wondering, you know, is the same problem present right around the country? And, you know, this is what I can't understand about the whole DHB system, is that it shouldn't matter where you live in the country, you should be getting the same treatment. But it seems that that's not the case, certainly in this case anyway. Yeah, it's a terrible situation. And as Amy was saying, it's, you know, it costs the country, and, you know, we've got to do something about it, for goodness sake.
Tuare, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Appreciate you coming onto the program.
Kia ora.
That's Tuare Potiki, the acting chair of the New Zealand Drug Foundation. It's just coming up to 5:03, and lots of response here. So I'll just quickly go to the panel in relation to some of the topics we've been talking about. Hi, Karen. Great conversation regarding climate change. The apathy is shown by the uproar over the large SUV tax and EV subsidy. The majority don't want to change their lifestyle, no matter the long-term effect for their descendants. Comment from both of you? Amy?
Oh, well, I'm married to a farmer, so we are pretty attached to the utes on the farm. And I think for me, the issue there is around what we've got to be doing is developing alternatives. Taxing people when there aren't alternatives doesn't fix it. It just drives more cost. So what I'd like to see is a lot more work being done on alternatives and incentives to move. I've moved to an EV. I've moved to solar power because those options are there. So on that specific one, my issue is more that you're taxing people who don't really have a choice, rather than thinking about driving options for people to move to low carbon and low climate emitting forms of transport. If we did more of that, I think people would be keen to take it up.
Oh, I think Amy's talked you out of a comment there, Ellen, but thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Ellen Blackman, thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Great to talk to you. And Amy Adams, thank you for joining us on
the
panel.
Thanks, Karen. It's been fun.
Coming up to Checkpoint with Lisa Owen. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. Good afternoon.